Hello and welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Much has been made recently of the Westerville teenager who ran away from home to Florida. She said she feared for her life. She said because she had converted to Christianity from Islam, she said her family would kill her if she returned. Most of the coverage has focused on the Islam versus Christianity issue, on the alleged violence issue, and a child's freedom to choose. But could the drama also be recast in the time-honored tradition of teenage rebellion? Surely 17-year-old Rivka Berry isn't the first teenager to reject her parents' religious values and rules. She just as easily could have hailed from a Protestant household to convert to Islam or Catholicism, Judaism or atheism, Hinduism, you name it, the list goes on. Joining me today to talk about adolescence and religion is Columbus pediatrician and award-winning children's author, Dr. Asma Bobinuddin. Hello, Asma.
Hi, Ann.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And on the phone, Susan Campbell. She's an award-winning Hartford Current columnist and author of the memoir Dating Jesus, about growing up in a fundamentalist Christian tradition. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Much of your story, Susan, revolves around your adolescent impressions of your inside world and the one on the outside.
Yes.
And you perceive there's a conflict, but you don't really put it into words necessarily until you're much older.
Exactly. I always admire people who at the age of 17, and I'll call her Rivka as if I know her. I've never met the young woman. I admire people who can step back and say, this is the theology for me. If that, in fact, is what happened, it took me a lot longer.
Often kids who are very devoted to one religion and they convert, that's not necessarily unusual that they're as devout in the new religion as they were in the old.
And you also have to factor in there's the extreme strong feelings of any convert. If you have chosen to convert to a particular religion, you tend to embrace that perhaps more wholeheartedly, and this is completely anecdotally, than someone who grew up in the religion and is a cultural Catholic or cultural you name it. Yeah, that may be some of what's at play here.
Susan, when did you start to, how old were you when you started to put things into words, you take those sort of organic feelings and start to form complete thoughts?
I think I started pretty young, although, as I said, it took me a lot longer to act on it. I was 8 in a Sunday school class and asked why a woman couldn't be a preacher, because in my theology, there are no women leadership, or no women in leadership. And I remember the Sunday school teacher tried to explain it to me, and I wasn't buying it, and I probably was a bit of a pill, but I kept asking the question, and he would give me a scripture, and because I was raised fundamentalist, I could give him 3 back. So I was fairly young when I started thinking, this actually doesn't seem fair to me, and then started reading the Bible with a different eye, maybe to prove my point, but also to see, does it really say this?
But outside of doing the dishes and who makes dinner, you didn't verbalize a lot of that to your folks, right?
Oh, Lord, no. Absolutely not. And when I'm reading all the, and, you know, I only know what I've read or seen on television, I'm reading the young woman's reaction and her fear of violence from her family. I shared that, and I don't think there was any, again, in my situation, there was no, absolutely nothing to indicate that I would be physically abused if I changed religion, but the fear was there.
Asma, in Alil's story,
Bilal.
Pardon me?
It's pronounced Bilal.
Bilal, sorry. The name of the story is My Name is Bilal, and it's about a boy who is a devout Muslim, but he feels uncomfortable in a society that where he is a very much of a minority and very different, and his sister as well. How common is it for them, for Muslim children, to reject a religion like this?
Well, Ann, I grew up in Marion, Ohio. I was the only Muslim kid in my elementary school and in my junior high, except for my siblings. And then I was the only non-Christian kid at Marion Catholic High School for most of my time there. So all throughout, I had a lot of questions because people would ask me, you know, why don't you eat pepperoni pizza? And I'd have to go home and ask my mom, Mom, why don't we eat pepperoni pizza? And try to sort out a lot of the issues, religious and cultural, at that time. So I think one of the biggest issues for me was fitting in with peers as well as maintaining fidelity to the family, my family and their faith of Islam. And we'd visit relatives in Pakistan every year. So I had a chance to be in a community that was Muslim and did share the different values. But it was a challenge. And I think that those are some of the emotions that I wanted to share in the story, My Name is Bilal, that struggle to fit in that I think many kids, and I'm speaking from the Muslim American perspective, go through of trying to be comfortable with who they are and have their own self-identity and their own values and also share in the larger community and connect with their peers and be a part of the larger group. So those were kind of the main issues. I think there's a lot of that soul searching, especially for kids who are more isolated from whatever, you know, different faiths. And I think that there are, you know, people who do rebel and people who do things which are against the faith because they want to fit in. So these are issues that the community is dealing with, and I'm sure other faith communities as well. If everybody's drinking in your high school, yet your faith teaches you shouldn't drink, how do you help your kids to maintain the values of your family or your faith and avoid, you know, going into harm's way when maybe there are other things going on with their friends, you know, smoking, other types of things like that. Now, in the case of Islam, there are more restrictions in terms of social interactions. Like if people are observant, they're not alone with a member of the opposite gender, so people don't date in the traditional Western way or, you know, probably wouldn't go to prom and things like that. So there are a lot of pressures for Muslim kids that are above and beyond perhaps what, you know, maybe others might experience.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you had a lot of pressures too, though. You weren't allowed to go to dances. You didn't. Yeah, prom. That's right. It killed me. I never went to prom either. If that's
well, I probably wouldn't have been asked, to be honest.
Either.
So it kind of saved me. But we had similar restrictions, not to the point, and I'm familiar with the restrictions somewhat in Islam. I could certainly be in a room with someone who wasn't related to me of the opposite gender. But we had it was a long list of do's and don'ts. Yeah.
How did you cope with that?
I railed against it in some cases, and in some cases it never even dawned on me that there was another way. I went to a secular high school. I had secular friends, but there was always this notion that they were the unsaved, and I was of the elect. And my job was to proselytize as much as possible and bring them into the elect, the fundamentalist Christian church I grew up in, or else they would go to hell. And I would go to hell if I didn't proselytize.
Big inspiration.
Big inspiration. I really don't want to go to hell, and I don't want my friends to go to hell. And I found it, because as an adolescent, you want so badly to fit in. I found it such a difficult line to walk, to adhere to the tenets of my faith, which very much involved talking about my faith a great deal. Quoting scripture. I mean, you've watched The Partridge Family, and then you come together and you're supposed to throw scriptures out with your friends. They look at you funny.
I suppose that's sort of something that you foist on people. And if you're mm-hmm. Muslim and a woman, it's what you're wearing often. It's there. Mm-hmm. It's obvious. There's no getting
you
away from that.
Yeah.
But in
yeah.
your religion, what was out there, no way of getting away from, was the proselytizing that was asked of you.
Big time. And we did not have a headscarf, but we were to wear very chaste clothing. And this was the 1970s. No one was wearing chaste clothing. So we did kind of stand out that way. But I did have the choice just to keep my mouth shut. And then I wouldn't out myself as somewhat different theologically. But again, the pressure was, if you keep your mouth shut, these people are going to hell and their souls are on your head. You
no
can't
pressure.
Win. No,
you're
right.
Listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 AM. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd like to hear your stories about adolescence and religion. I'm figuring that one of the hardest parts about what you did, Susan, was the proselytizing. And you talk in your book about the forced indoctrination of children and the damage that can do, at least as you experienced it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Because that was something you came to much later in life in terms of
a
criticism.
I think it took me moving away from that area where my particular church is much stronger than it is in the Northeast where I live now. I was an adult, and when people would talk about their childhoods, I would throw out a little anecdote, you know, nicely packaged, and I would see horrified faces, and I would think, well, what, you didn't? And I had friends who were not in the church, but not particularly close, because, again, they're the unsaved, I'm the elect. There's an other mentality about them, and I think it took some perspective of age, time in the river heals all wounds, of thinking about what I learned, and there was good in what I learned. I can't discount all of it. That's the difficulty, I think, of leaving a faith is, oh, man, there were some wonderful people there. I learned some valuable lessons. Look out for people with less than you. That was a very fundamentalist Christian thing. On the other hand, the price you pay as a woman is that you're a secondary citizen in my particular theology, and you have to look at everyone else as the other. And I just couldn't believe my Methodist friends were going to hell. They were so nice. So why send the Baptist to hell?
Asma, you mentioned the community and how important that was. And when you'd go back to Pakistan with your family, which is where your folks are from, you felt that unity and that sense of unity, and you had that opportunity to be part of that group. Even though you were growing up in Marion, you were somewhat isolated. I imagine that has got to be a huge issue for Rivka Berry as she converts and she's moved away from her family and away from the community. We don't know. We can only speculate. But I wondered what you thought when you heard about this young woman making such a big break.
Right. And that community issue was very much a reaffirmation for me that somewhere, you know, there are other people who, you know, don't maybe that also follow the same social restrictions and have, you know, observe the same holidays, these types of things. So it was helpful because otherwise in my world in Marion, there wasn't anybody else who even understood. And you'd be constantly explaining yourself that, you know, why don't you date or why do you have the dietary restrictions or, you know, things like that. But with Rivka, I feel for her. I mean, I was really saddened because, you know, she's obviously troubled. There are a lot of issues going on. She's run away. The family has to deal with a lot of issues, and there has been so much, I guess, a circus atmosphere with the agendas and the people getting involved and people who seem to be exploiting the situation on one side or the other. And to be part of this Muslim community and hear the accusations about Muslims in central Ohio that caused a Florida judge to say that Rivka couldn't come back to Ohio because the community in central Ohio could harm her, I was just appalled. And I am just speechless. I have been a member of this community for more than 30 years, and that is completely ludicrous. I mean, it would be laughable except that it happened. And when people actually interview the family, talk, you know, there have been news articles, the Franklin County Children's Services looked into the family, New Albany School District, you know, she was a cheerleader, she was an honor student, she worked part-time in a Chinese restaurant, there have been no history of abuse in the family, the police chief came out and said the father seems to be a very loving, you know, dad who's really concerned about the health and welfare of his daughter, and there's no history of abuse. They talked to neighbors, they talked to where the mother works. Nobody had anything bad to say about the family or the community. So that's been an added challenge that as in America. And I think, Susan, also with the evangelical community, probably you understand also what I'm saying, that sometimes the demonization of the faith and of the people who follow it doesn't represent the people that you know. Now, you know, the people that I know are loving and kind and believe in God and want to do good for their community and love their children. And these are the values that I have internalized growing up as a Muslim in Central Ohio among the Muslim community as well as, you know, in the larger Central Ohio community growing up in a small town. And I it's really an injustice to have all that type of misinformation out there for people who don't know the family. You know, they're trying to try a religion or there was an honor killing someplace else or, you know, those types of things when actually, you know, the police departments and the children's services people and people whose job it is to look into these things have said that, you know, her accusations are not founded in any way. So that just also points to the fact that what's going on in her head, you know, this poor girl, and where is she and will she be able to reconcile with her family who has said that you are free to practice, you know, whatever faith you want, just come home, we love you. And will she be able to do that? You know, with all these recent issues, is she going to be able to sort through these types of things and really work things out the more time that progresses and the more time that she's separated? And, of course, that's, you know, for the future, the whole future. If they can't reconcile, then that she's going to be isolated as well. And you know, she can certainly be a Christian. I mean, that's what her father has said repeatedly. And, you know, of course, there's Christians here, and she can still be part of the family's community that accepts her and wants her back and will support her in her own decisions. Islam espouses freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. You have to follow your heart in what you believe. God doesn't accept just rote prayer or doing something because somebody is forcing you. God accepts the convictions that are in your heart.
I want to get right back with that. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Hartford Current award-winning columnist and author Susan Campbell and Columbus pediatrician and award-winning author Asma Mobin Uddin. Don't go away.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer today. WOSU is currently looking for a daytime volunteer to assist with the administration of the volunteer program. You must be computer proficient, and you may go through an application and interview process. For more information on this and other volunteer opportunities, visit us online at wosu.org/volunteers. And in the weather forecast, cloudy skies today, a chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon and a high of 75. Skies clear a little bit overnight, but there's still a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening and a low of 58 degrees. Some sunshine on Wednesday, still a slight chance of rain showers and a high of 78. And looking ahead to Thursday, a 30% chance of rain, cloudy, and a high of 79. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's currently 68 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now, back to All Sides.
Welcome back to WOSU 820 AM. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you want to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us what your stories, some of your war stories from growing up in a religion that maybe didn't rub you right when you were an adolescent. Susan, when you heard, you've obviously followed this story. You said so that you'd been intrigued by it from the beginning. Mm-hmm. What did you think when you first heard about it?
I felt so bad for the family, mostly because I think, as Ozma said, this really shows a family that needs some help. And I watched an interview where Rivka was crying and clutching I believe it was the minister whose house she was living in. I felt bad, and I saw it from the perspective as, you know, growing up fundamentalist, where it's so easy to assign attributes to a group of people when you know none, and all you know is what you've read or saw on television. And there's a very strong Muslim community here in Connecticut, and I'm friends with several of the people, and I always wonder if they ever get tired of explaining themselves. There's one, a cardiac surgeon here at a hospital. He and his wife are out there all the time and continually explaining Islam and trying to put it into perspective, because there's fear there. There was fear about my religion, but there wasn't the attendant, the bad names you can call someone. And I know these people, and I think, I would get so tired of explaining myself, as the Barry family has had to do, as the mother and father sitting there explaining, we love our daughter, we want her back. I mostly felt bad for the family. And I have to say, I felt a small amount, maybe a large amount of anger for the Christian group whom Rivka met through Facebook. I felt that wasn't a fair thing for them to do, to take her in and not tell the family. I thought that was very short-sighted.
I didn't mention earlier, and I should have, that Ozma also is president of the Ohio chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Hmm. So how does all this fit in? What are you folks talking about at the council these days?
Well, as Susan mentioned, a lot of it in the Central Ohio area now is, unfortunately, just defense. And you hate to do that, because we want to do outreach. We want people to know the Muslim community. Studies have consistently shown that people who rate themselves as having a higher knowledge of Islam or actually knowing a Muslim have a much more positive view of Islam or Muslims. And people who have a lot of the hostility and the anger and the misperceptions also will rate themselves as having little to no knowledge of Islam or not even knowing Muslims. So part of our task is to be out there in the community and to let people know who we are and to be a contributing part of the community. But unfortunately, you get distracted by, you know, having to defend yourself or, you know, these crazy accusations against a mosque, you know, the Noor Mosque that I've attended. I was there the very first day they opened in 2006, and we attend regularly with my family. I take my kids there. I've never heard anybody talk in any way of espousing any kind of violence or causing harm to anybody. On the contrary, people are very much encouraging the community to be good citizens. They have blood drives. They had a community health fair open to the public recently. They're opening a free clinic next month, which is in association with OSU, to provide free medical care for everybody. They were a polling precinct, and people voted at the Noor Mosque in the last presidential election, so they're encouraging Muslims to do their civic duty. So a lot of, unfortunately, we get distracted into just having to defend ourselves against crazy accusations instead of trying to really be out there and build the relationships in addition, you know, that we would like to do to help people who have fears, who have concerns, know us.
A part of it's fear that's bigoted possibly and the fear of the unknown and the fear of the strange and the fear of, you know, just because of all the politics of our world these days. But also we people have our – it sounds like the Christian group that she's become affiliated with is welcoming someone into their fold. And I wonder if anyone's posed the question to anybody, what if you were the father and the mother of a 17-year-old girl who rejected your religious values and your rules and regulations? How would it feel? And I think that's very difficult for people to do still. I don't know if it's any easier now. In some ways, it seems like it might be easier now after all of the upheaval since 2001 and all of the bigotry that has circulated since then. Is it any easier? Because Susan mentioned you must get tired of having to explain yourself all the time. But would you rather explain yourself or not?
Well, we consider it a responsibility and a trust to be here and to let the community know who we are and what our faith teaches. So meaning like it or not, it is a responsibility. And, you know, again, if you're a person of faith, you don't think things are by accident and you feel that, you know, God puts you in a situation for a reason. And so we're grateful to be able to be here. I think it sounds funny, but it is a great time to be a Muslim in America 2009 because I love my faith. I love my country. And I need people to see that they're not incompatible. And, you know, you can make a lot of difference in being out there. So I appreciate that opportunity. Is it easier for people to convert between different faiths? I think the tension, the hostility, the fear, as you mentioned, and also with the communication methods we have today, internet, you can really spread a lot of hate and a lot of bigotry in a very anonymous way. So I think that frees people up to even maybe not be as careful in their discussion and their discourse. So we tend to take a lot of heat that maybe when you're meeting somebody face to face, they wouldn't share. But behind the anonymity of the computer screen, they're quick to send, you know, press send and be able to send all kinds of stuff out. So that makes it a much more hostile environment, I think. Plus with how quickly information can be disseminated with all the viruses and everything that can be sent, the viral, you know, fear-mongering or whatever that goes out, I think all the emotions are very high. So I think it's harder maybe in the past when I was growing up, also in the 70s, like Susan mentioned, people didn't know anything about Islam or Pakistan. They just –
good or bad.
Right. They thought it was exotic that I'd go to Pakistan in December – over the December holidays. They would ask me, you know, do you believe in God? Or, you know, they had no idea even that Islam is one of the Abrahamic faiths and we accept, you know, Noah and Abraham and Moses and we love and respect and revere Jesus as one of the five greatest prophets of God. And, you know, Muslims worship the God of Abraham. People didn't know that then. And they're still re-asking that question today. But today I think there's that added issue of, you know, what does the religion teach? How is 9/11 related, if at all, to Islam? And, you know, what's up with these people and why do they hate us? And all these kinds of other questions that were not there when I was growing up. So, yes, we have many converts. You know, we have people who convert into the Muslim community and they hide their faith from their Christian pastor parents and things. I mean, we have situations like that as well. And then you have people who are disenchanted and do move away from the religion, especially youth. Lots of youth may not follow and may actually drink or date or, you know, have all kinds of the same types of issues and problems that other adolescents in Central Ohio have, with the added issue of having, you know, maybe devout parents that if their parents knew would totally be another issue for them. So we have both ways. I mean, it's an open society. We live in America. People are in contact with everyone else. And so, yes, we are dealing with these issues. And it is, I think, more of a challenge because of the fear and just kind of the hostility out there.
You brought up the issue of the internet and social media. Susan, if you'd had the internet and social media back in the 70s when you were struggling with a lot of these issues internally and not verbalizing them outwardly, what difference do you think that might have made?
That's an excellent question. I almost can't even think like that. I know I would have found a community of like-minded young women probably quicker than I did, and I think I would have had some more fruitful conversations because I found in trying to introduce the topic either in Sunday school, church camp, I mean, wherever, it made my cohorts uncomfortable. because it was as if, not that I was denying this particular approach to God, but that I was denying God. And it made it really difficult to talk about it with anyone. I certainly didn't want to come off as that, but that would have been fabulous, I think. But then, too, you can fall, I mean, as may have happened, you can fall into, with the naivete of a teenager, you can fall into a group that perhaps might not be in your best interest. And I'm not saying Rivka's there, but I'm fascinated that the judge has called for mediation. I wonder how effective that could be.
Mediation between the
family,
the two families.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I'm not clear on the details of that. Who's going to lead that, and what the final goal is?
There are some legal implications in all mm-hmm. of this. There always are when children are involved, increasingly because of so many factors in our society today. Not the least of which is the internet. We have a clip from the attorney for the Berry family that will play right now, and then talk about that.
If Florida retains jurisdiction over this child, forget about religion. That's a distraction. It will deplete people's rights over their children when it comes to anything, any allegation. This is a slippery slope, and that's the reason, this is such an essential case.
Okay. What do you think, Asma?
Well, I agree. Rivka was in Ohio. She lived in Ohio. She'd been in New Albany since 2004. Her family is here. She ran away. And having been in Florida a couple weeks, my understanding is that case should have been referred back to the authorities in Ohio. And certainly if there's any question about harm to a minor, I mean, I'm a pediatrician. You have the duty to report. You have the duty to evaluate. And I absolutely think that, was seeing the video from her, that, yes, Franklin County Children's Services and the police and everybody else should investigate and should make sure that this child is completely safe before sending her home. That's kind of like a no-brainer. But why is Ohio not competent to do that? We have, we have Franklin County Children's Services, and we have a police department, and we have, concerned citizens, and we can do this in Ohio. What really concerned me was the fear-mongering in Florida that said that the judge in Florida, where she'd been for only 2 weeks, which I think is not a precedent that if somebody's only been there a couple weeks, at least from what I understand. How do you get the right to just say, well, we're not going to send her back and let the authorities take care of it there? I'm not saying you have to send her back to her family. I'm saying put her into the custody of the authorities and agencies in Ohio that are mandated to deal with these type of issues. So I think that's also put a big block in the situation, or another wedge, because now you've got all kinds of groups with different agendas and this circus that's going on. And how do you investigate? They've had reporters from the Orlando Sentinel who have been flown up here. They've had their agencies and police department people from Florida who have been flown up here to interview the family.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so Florida is paying for this. And I empathize with the taxpayers who are saying, why are we paying for all of this? Ohio can handle it. Send it back to them. And everybody that's come up here and actually interviewed the family and all, they have written, they have been very positive about the family and the support and all that. So I think, why would you – why, except by the issue that, if we send her back, she could get killed by the – I mean, this is just ludicrous. And I just don't understand how it could happen when we have rule of law in this country and we're supposed to handle these things in a way that is not affected by this type of fear-mongering stuff. And then you've got the political issues that came up and the governor and all these types of things and who's looking for votes and how is the community down there with a public opinion, which is just totally a smear campaign. There's all kinds of issues that I feel have encroached upon the basic rights of the family and Rivka to have this issue dealt with by the appropriate authorities in her home state. And I'm sure that they would be fair to everybody. But you're just saying, Ohio's incompetent to deal with it. And I think that's just wrong. And I'm surprised that we've allowed it. But it's happening.
Susan Campbell, what are folks saying out in Connecticut? You're kind of not attached to either state. What are they talking mm-hmm. about? What did you think?
The conversations that I've been a part of and that I've listened in on have been exactly what Asma just said. Why was this not handled in Ohio? Why was she not returned? And I would never advocate returning a distraught teenager to a home in which she doesn't feel safe. However, if everyone who's interviewed the family, the Berry family, comes away saying they seem beyond competent, why keep her in Florida? That added to the circus terribly. And that, beyond the fear mongering, I don't understand how that happened, and I don't understand how the judge kept her there or allowed her to stay there the length of time she has.
Okay, we have a call from Mark. He wants to ask about the concept of actions versus beliefs when converting. Mark, you're on the air.
Okay, I guess the question I have in terms of a young person changing religion, sometimes the focus is so much on faith and what one believes, and sometimes maybe what's more important, not so much what you believe, but what you do in your everyday life. And, for example, my mother, when she was about 16 or 17, she had been raised in a Presbyterian Christian family, and on her own, she converted and became a Catholic. No one came out and encouraged her to do it. No one proselytized her. She just thought that it was a more appropriate fit for her, and her family was a little surprised that they were not hostile. So I've got a feeling from this situation, she's from a nice, devout family. I think that they're very responsible. She seemed like a nice girl, but somehow it felt like outside forces intervened to create turmoil where it was unnecessary. And I guess your thoughts on sort of the difference between what you your responsibilities in your life and what you believe in, which can be very heavily influenced by your age. Easy for a young person to be over-enthusiastic. So,
okay,
that's my question.
The enthusiasm of youth, is that playing a part here? What do you think, Cosmo?
Well, one thing in response to the caller's comments, I do think that the issue is the more recent turning her away from her family and trying to separate her from her family. It's not the issue of converting or converting to Christianity. Even the dad said when she was 14 years old and she filled out a babysitting form, she put Christian as her religion. So she has been interested in Christianity for many years, and in her high school, people knew that she was a Christian. And the family knew also earlier because they had been, you know, getting hints and things. So it wasn't an issue of just finding out that she converted. It was more, you know, the separation of the family, running away, being taught to hate your birth community and things like that, and unfounded fears and things like that. I think that's more of the issue. Now, talking about the enthusiasm of youth and the enthusiasm of converts kind of coming together, well, sure. And I think the developmental tasks of adolescents also play into this. Adolescents are not children. They're not adults, but they are starting to take on, you know, some of those tasks. They're developing their own self-identities separate from their parents and their community. They are thinking abstractly now. They can question the beliefs maybe that they had earlier. So there are many developmental stages that are confusing for adolescents and hopefully preparing them for adulthood. But during that time, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on, whether it's physical, biological, social. So it's a very confusing time. And I think all that confusion, in addition to, you know, the things that were mentioned, make it a very complex situation that needs to be dealt with care and, you know, need counseling and, you know, help for the family that way, as opposed to just, you know, the media circus that's going to make it so much more difficult to get to the core issues and help the family and Rivka resolve these issues so that they're comfortable and they can be a family again, whatever faith they choose to follow.
Yeah, I want to get back to that issue about what the family can do, this family or any family, when they're confronted with this kind of situation. Right now, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Hartford Current award-winning columnist and author Susan Campbell and Columbus pediatrician and award-winning author Asma Mobeen-Uddin. If you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, you'd like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is WOSU 820 AM.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's edition of Fresh Air, young adults are the largest uninsured group in America. We'll hear what it's like to get a cancer diagnosis when you're in your 20s and underinsured. Two women who have been there will be the guests on Fresh Air. They've also written about young adults with cancer and the unique problems they face. That's on Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And remember, it's simple and easy to renew your WOSU membership. Just call 1-866-897-9000. 9678 or go online to WOSU.org and click on the Pledge Now box along the left margin. Whether you're a first-time member or looking to renew your membership, your online gift is more important than ever. Thank you for your support of WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast today, cloudy skies, a chance of rain and thunderstorms this afternoon, a high of 75. Clearing skies tonight, still a slight chance of rain and a low of 58. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher. Call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joining me today to talk about adolescence and religion and the conflicts sometimes therein is Dr. Asma Mobinuddin. She is a pediatrician and author of the children's book, My Name is Alil.
Bilal. Okay. My name is Bilal.
Bilal. Okay. I can see where my mistake is. The story of a Muslim American boy who tries to hide his Muslim identity from his classmates. Asma also is president of the Ohio chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And by phone, Susan Campbell, an award-winning columnist for the Hartford Courant. Susan also wrote Dating Jesus, her memoir about growing up in a fundamentalist Christian tradition that eventually collided with her own feminist nature. Susan, what sort of advice would you give a family like Rivka's, who is not only coping with this kind of conflict personally, but I guess we can't even begin to advise people when they're being spread all over the news like this, but just privately, how can people manage these sorts of things and still keep their families together?
Well, I will say, although it's anathema to a journalist to say this, don't talk to the press for a while. You really need to be out of the – no, seriously.
Yes.
I have actually told people you may not want to talk to me. I'm not a good journalist because it's so hard to work this out, and how much harder is it to work it out when everyone's watching and is weighing in? I think just from the example of my own family, we are all over the map theologically and politically. And if we want to start an argument, we'll say, so, who'd you vote for? And invariably, we don't agree. But in the end, you love your family. And as tragically flawed as they and you are, my only advice, and they're probably already, it sounds like they're already following, is just remember you love your family. And that transcends a lot. And the father has said, although he would prefer that she would be a Muslim, as my family would prefer I would be a fundamentalist Christian. In the end, that's Rivka, and that's their child, and they love her.
How about you, Asma? What kind of counsel could you begin to give?
Right. I would say, well, one thing about just being in the media and things, unfortunately, because of the fear-mongering in this situation, to humanize the family, I think it's important that people see them because they have their stereotypes. And if they don't hear the dad, you know, saying, look, here's a picture of my daughter. She was a cheerleader. I mean, how can you say that I'm beating her up for not, you know, wearing a burqa? It just, you know, kind of brings it home a little bit. But in general, I mean, be open with your kids. Keep those channels of communication open, even though it's hard for you. You know, try not to, just try to remember, again, like you mentioned, this is your child. This child is your responsibility for nurturing and taking care of and being there for. And, you know, support her and just try to keep the channels of communication open. And try to, I think you can certainly set limits on the, set the example for the values that you hope that she will continue to follow. And that's with anybody. Whatever our children are when they're with us, ultimately they're going to make their decisions as adults, how they dress, what they believe, what they eat, where they live. They will make those decisions. And we can only hope that we have had the chance to maybe be a good example for the values so that they would value, you know, kind of some of the similar things. And don't sweat the small stuff. You know, really try to keep the connection. Your daughter, you love her. Again, you know, Christians believe in God. Muslims believe in God. There's a commonality there. To try to, you know, kind of work with the common points and make the basic thing be that you love her and you're there for her and she's part of the community, regardless of how she chooses, to practice her beliefs, is very important in this situation because there is such a rift and such a division. And it seems that from the video, she's, for whatever reason and wherever she got the ideas, she's afraid of her family. Mm-hmm. And they need to break through even that type of thing that, no, you know, honey, that's not the case and you don't have anything to fear and we are a family. So I think they're trying to do that. I think not forcing your kids is important because especially in, you know, places like America where there's so many different faith traditions and beliefs, you can't force them to follow a particular culture or belief, but you can help reason with them and help them understand why you believe it's important and know that you respect them. And I think that's more likely to have people make responsible choices than putting them in some type of rebellious mode where, you know, okay, you have to dress this way or you have to, where as soon as they're out of the house, if they don't agree with you, then they're taking it off, or you can't do this. And then as soon as they're out of the house, they're disobeying you. So trying to, you know, keep the communication open and reason with them and be compassionate and set the kind of show them what your values are, but also let them know that they will ultimately make their decisions and they're responsible before God for making their decisions ultimately, and try to transfer some of that responsibility to their own internal sense of moral, you know, good and bad and their own relationship with God is probably a good way to go.
Is this a topic in the mosque right now, talking to families, talking to parents, to make sure, just as a community, it could be happening in any congregation anywhere, if this were to be replayed in you know, St. Peter's Church, you know, Catholic Church, it may be a point for conversation. Has that spurred any?
Right. And I think
besides the sociopolitical
issues, the suddenness with which this whole issue came up, I think kind of took everybody by surprise, and they were still scratching their heads over the, huh, kill her? You know, like, huh, what? And, you know, they're still kind of scratching their heads at that. But sure, the issue, and I have heard people talk about maybe engaging families and youth about some of these issues. And certainly I think mosques as well as churches and other groups, they're doing their best to try to engage the youth and have the youth attend and find religion relevant in their lives today in America. I mean, the mosque has a couple of basketball hoops, you know, outside people play basketball. They've got a foosball table. They've got ping pong tables, you know, things to try to get the community of youth involved at the mosque, you know, picking up things, hopefully good things in addition to hanging out and things like that. So I think, yes, there certainly is this, the discussion starting. I've heard some people talk about maybe having some, you know, discussions with families and youth just to kind of talk about some of these issues, because it's just been so quick that this has been thrust into the media and the spotlight.
Susan, in your book, you mentioned how your mom, you think, maybe didn't sweat the small stuff when it came to your hemlines. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it did give you a little – it seemed like you learned, got a little insight on your mother, and maybe that she wasn't as inflexible as
– I did. When Ozma said clothing restrictions, I thought of hemlines, again, the 70s, and the shorter the better. And my mother was – she made my clothes, and she was a fabulous seamstress, and she would hem my skirts. And I, of course, would wear them very low on my hips, and she would say – why are you wearing these? These are not hip huggers. And I said, oh, no, everybody's wearing them like this. So that when I left for school, I could hike my skirt back up and it would be a good 3 inches shorter than she'd intended. She knew. She absolutely knew I was trying to fake her out. But I didn't feel comfortable saying, Mom, nobody's wearing these prairie dresses except the little girl on Little House on the Prairie. Please don't make me. So instead, I thought I was, you know, doing an end run around her, and she knew. She absolutely knew. And I saw in several situations where she would look at me and roll her eyes or give me these little, what I took to mean, hidden messages that, you know what, go ahead, be a kid.
Ozma.
Yeah, I think one thing that brings to mind also is that when you talked about advice, if you can try to focus as a family on the values and then maybe let your kids work out how to express those values, so stressing the inner modesty. The idea of respect for one's body, the respect, the idea of dignity between men and women and dignified interactions, about not being exploited for physical characteristics, whether you're female or whether you're male. Maybe work on some of those ultimate values, and then let the kids, although they may rebel a little bit here and there and reject some of the stuff, later on maybe they'll realize that the strength of that ultimate value would make them want to have a longer hemline or cover cover their body more or things like that. So I think, you know, trying to focus on the values as opposed to laying down the specific restrictions that, you know, you can only wear this or you can only wear that might help as adolescents are going through that rebellion phase and going through that struggle and trying to find out what they really feel is important.
Yeah, Susan, you sort of had sort of a parallel experience along those lines. You were a jock, you know, thanks to Title VII, and you were interested in those kind of things and not particularly girly, as you put it. So you weren't out trying to be immodest by any means.
No, I wasn't, but I had a different relationship with my body, I think in large part because Title IX told me to get out and run with it, and it didn't matter if my hind end was a particular shape so long as it moved me down the basketball court, and it was a fabulous introduction. And I think a lot of young women who are athletes can avoid a lot of the body image. Of course, obviously some sports push them right back into it, but not the ones I did. And then I could realize my full potential as an athlete, and I was in no way a fabulous one, but I enjoyed it very much, and that took my mind off of worrying about my looks. It didn't matter what my legs looked like so long as I could run fast.
And you were attendant on homecoming court, or was that prom court?
I was. That was awful. I really didn't want that. I think it was because my brothers were on the football team, and they threatened people if they didn't vote for me. I wasn't dating. I wasn't popular like that. And it was a very uncomfortable position to sit in that wrought iron white chair and be a girl. I had all kinds of issues about why am I cheering these boys on when they don't come to my basketball game and cheer me on? You know, so why am I wearing this mom the size of my head? But I did it.
Yeah, and as you said, it was Title IX, not Title VII. Title IX that made
enough.
Pardon me? Yeah, well, yeah. Both odd numbers. But
I heard nine. Don't worry about it.
We have a caller, Joyce, who wants to ask, I think, a pretty good question and learn more about something that's sort of been at the crux of all of this. Joyce, you're on the air.
Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Enjoy your program.
Thank you.
I had heard about honor killing, so I would like her to just address that problem or that issue, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, Asma. Fill us in.
Thank you. And I would also refer people to an article in the Florida that was available in Florida by Dr. Gwendolyn Simmons, who is with the University of Florida, and she teaches Islamic law and about its effect on women. So there's two different issues. One is the issue of honor killings, which is not an Islamic practice, and as she says in the article, it predates Islam. In some societies, it happens that male relatives would kill a girl or a woman who's committed a sexual sin to restore honor to the family. It has nothing to do with the religion. It's against the law in Islamic countries because it's murder. Yet, you know, it does happen. It's a social ill. Like, we have domestic violence in our country, even though it's against the law. Some people do it, and some people sometimes get off.
They give this label honor killings to
right.
it,
so that's that's honor killings. That is a completely separate issue. This has nothing to do with honor killings. The other issue or question, again, it just shows you how everything is kind of lumped together when you're talking about Islam or Muslim beliefs. That's a totally separate issue. It has nothing to do with converting. The other question, though, is about apostasy or changing your religion. And does someone who changes their religion out from Islam to something else have to be killed? That's not an honor killing. It's something different. But the other question is, now people say it says it in the Quran. Rifka said it said it in the Quran, which was completely false. The Quran does not in any verse ever say that somebody should be killed for changing their religion from Islam. And the Quran mentions converting or changing out of Islam 14 different times. But it only talks about recompense in the hereafter, you know, when you meet God. It does not ever say anything. There are many examples in the time of the Prophet also. So there are examples in Islamic history as to people who converted, then they went back to their old religion, then they converted. Now, the issue came up that in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, when the Muslims were an entity and a community, then there were other tribes who were another political entity, like the pagan tribes of that time, who didn't like this new religion that said worship the one God, and they were attacking the Muslim tribe. So the pagans were part of a tribe. The Muslims were together as a political entity. So when someone converted from Islam, say, to paganism, not only did they change their personal beliefs, but they were making a political change at a time of war. So it was understood as an act of treason. I mean, you had somebody in your own camp who hears all what's going on, and then they go over to the pagan camp. So with that in mind, that idea of that association with treason, there are earlier scholars and all who have said that in those types of cases, that apostasy, that is, like treason, should be treated the same way treason is, and people could be killed for it. So those were what the earlier scholar says. But if you look at the idea of personal conscience, the Quran itself says, let there be no compulsion in religion. Chapter 2, verse 256, let there be no compulsion in religion. So that is a clear verse from the Quran, whereas the Quran never says that you kill somebody for converting out of their faith. And if you want to look at more, you know, Islamic scholars, especially recently American scholars who have information about this, I would recommend going to apostasyandislam.blogspot.com. apostasyandislam.blogspot.com. And you will see more than 100 Muslim scholars from all different, you know, organizations and religious backgrounds and legal backgrounds that talk about this distinction between, you know, what was earlier, you know, mentioned versus the issue of personal freedom of conscience, which Islam absolutely espouses. You know, Islam believes in freedom of conscience, freedom of religion. And if you don't really believe in God, you can't live a lie. There's no purpose. God knows what's in your heart. So just to be acting out a religion because for some other reason than you really believe it is living a lie. And Islam does not ask someone to do that. You have to be truthful with yourself. You're going to be truthful before God on the Day of Judgment. So there's no concept of forcing conversion or, you know, somebody acting as a Muslim when they don't really believe. It doesn't make any sense.
Susan, your memoir is often humorous. I loved it, and it,
I hope
it
God
deals
has a sense of humor.
Well, that
I'm so dead if he does.
Well, I was wondering if after writing the memoir, living your life and coming to the conclusions you did, if you were to go back, how would you do anything differently?
Probably not a bit. Again, I got a lot of good out of my religion, and I still live the particular part of the religion I embrace. But I just, I think I'd probably have to play it out as I did and wait until I was firm and understood my own theology. I think it's incredibly hard to form your own theology, and I was a little bit lazy there in my 20s and 30s. And I think I can't imagine what I've done differently. And I don't mean that to sound arrogant, as if I made all the right choices. I made some tragically bad ones, but, religion should be a thing of joy, and I'm on that Blogspot now, and I'm looking at it. Let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clear from error. What a beautiful line! I just think that's fabulous, and I think in this situation, the more we get to know one another's sacred text, the real text, not the text that's quoted by people who haven't read it, the more I think we'll find commonalities. The differences make us interesting, but it's the commonalities that draw us together. And I just really hope for this family they find some peace outside the limelight. And I do appreciate that they need to be talking. I just feel bad for them that role falls to them. Because really their first, in my case, in my family, my first responsibility is to my family. I understand I need to also let people know that my particular theology is not big and scary. But I would just want my daughter back.
Well, we're out of time. Many thanks to Columbus pediatrician and children's author Dr. Asma Mubeen-Uddin. She will be this Saturday at the Barnes & Noble at Polaris for a book signing of My Name is Bilal, among others. That's at Saturday, September 12th at 2 p.m. And also thank you for joining me, Hartford Current columnist and author Susan Campbell. Really appreciate you, Susan, from across the miles, giving us some of your insights.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks also to the many people who helped launch this maiden voyage of All Sides with Ann Fisher, especially producer Linda Taylor and associate producer Amy Jerovich, who also is behind the controls today, our intern Tyler Adams, and everyone at WOSU for welcoming me so warmly to the fold. Thanks to the wonderful guys at Integrate who designed our fab new logo, which you can see at WOSU.org, and also the brilliant Alan DeCenzo, who composed All Sides' beautiful theme music. We'll see you next time on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.